hear from you, Representative Daniel Valrose.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Craig Johnston. I represent the plaintiff appellant in this matter, Mr. Daniel Valrose. We believe that the trial court erred in granting a motion for summary judgment in favor of the defendant appellee, University Medical Center, who I will probably refer to a lot this morning as UMC, just because that's the way they're referred to typically in Lubbock, Texas. But this case is a Title VII retaliation case. Mr. Valrose is a former employee of UMC. He was a male PICU nurse. He was a pediatric intensive care nurse in the PICU department at UMC. He was a male nurse in the department that was predominantly female. Mr. Valrose claims that he was retaliated against after he made a claim of discrimination and harassment to his supervisor. UMC filed a motion for summary judgment in this case, claiming that Mr. Valrose, one, did not engage in a protected activity because, according to UMC, the conduct complained of by him could not have constituted conduct prohibited by Title VII. UMC also filed a summary judgment on the grounds that Mr. Valrose could not show that he suffered an adverse employment action caused by the retaliation. Trial court found, as a matter of law, the second point, and that is that Mr. Valrose did not suffer an adverse employment action. They did not rule on the issue of whether or not he engaged in a protected activity because this is a de novo review. Of course, we raised both issues on appeal or discussed both issues on appeal. Our position is pretty straightforward in this case. We believe that the summary judgment evidence created a genuine issue of material fact concerning whether Mr. Valrose engaged in a protected activity. In other words, there is an issue of fact regarding whether it was reasonable for Mr. Valrose to believe that the conduct reported by him violated the laws against gender discrimination. We also believe that the summary judgment evidence created a genuine issue of material fact concerning whether Mr. Valrose suffered
an
adverse employment action.
Kind of an interesting concept, whether an employee believes that it was reasonable. I mean, I assume that reasonable belief assumes the knowledge of the law, some knowledge of the law.
So the rule is that under Title VII, an employee engages in protected activity if the employee opposes a practice the employee believes violated the laws.
I understand, but in other words, if you believed that Title VII protected green hair, and he says, you know, I didn't know. I mean, I thought it protected all employment discrimination. That's my belief because I'm not a lawyer. Does that satisfy that he is protesting a practice made unlawful by Title VII because he was discriminated against on the basis of the color of his hair?
No, sir. The test is objective reasonableness.
Right.
We believe that that's a jury issue.
So objective. Well, now, that'd be a legal issue, wouldn't it? Objective reasonableness?
Well, was it reasonable for Mr. Valrose to believe that the conduct violated Title VII?
No, you're not saying that. You just said the opposite of that. It's whether an objective person would believe, not Mr. Valrose.
Yes, an objective person, but I believe that would be a jury question, a question for the jury that could be easily handled with did Mr. Valrose engage in a protected activity and with the definition of a protected activity.
How do you define objective person? That's just not to hold up your argument anymore. But
I'm sorry, what was it?
I said, how would you define objective person? How would you instruct the jury to determine what kind of knowledge would an objective person have to have?
I would just, an employee, I would define protected activity as an employee opposes a practice the employee believes or reasonably believes was violated the laws against gender discrimination. I think that you would still have to show. I mean, it would have to be reasonable. In other words, I believe that, you know, they made a comment about the color green. Obviously, I think the jury is well.
Go ahead with your argument.
I'm
sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
Okay. As I was saying, we also believe that the summary judgment evidence was sufficient to show that Mr. Valrose suffered an adverse employment action. We believe that the trial court, in making
what is the adverse employment action he suffered?
In this case, there were two. One was he was, and I'll get to the facts. The
adverse employment action has to be inflicted by the company or by the hospital.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so what did the hospital do to him?
We believe, and I'll outline the evidence in a few minutes, but we believe that one was they put him, he was reprimanded and placed on a training program based upon false reports that were filed by the people that he had complained about. The person who had, and the evidence in this is he reported the conduct on March 2nd, 2011. From March 2nd to March 7th, the nurses whom he complained about filed false reports with the supervisor saying that Mr. Valderez had violated the rules or violated procedures, violated protocols.
Are you saying that management knew that there were faults?
Well, yes, that's what the summary judgment, for the purposes of summary judgment evidence, Mr. Valderez said when he met with the manager, he told the manager that, or the department head, that the reports were false. He told her that they were being filed because as retaliation because he had reported them. He asked for an opportunity to rebut those reports and was not given that opportunity.
But he was told also that everybody, whether they're false or not, are sent to training, and that was what happened to him. Is that right?
Well, he was reprimanded and sent to training, based upon those false reports.
Did he ever go to the training sessions?
He attempted to, and what happened was he worked the graveyard shift. He worked the overnight shift. And this was also one of his claims of retaliation, is they specifically set that training during the day hours, during the daytime, and he was he made them, but he was unable to make all of them. One, because he was subject to a subpoena where he had to go testify in a criminal case involving somebody completely different, in Midland, and so that was one training session that he missed. I believe another training session in this was just simply because of a funeral or an illness in his family. But
did his company require him to go to work the night before and then do the training the next morning?
Yes, sir.
And how long was that training supposed to be?
Well, it would be during the day.
I mean, the next day.
I don't know exactly what time the training was set up during the day, but it was the...
Was it part of his work schedule is my question.
No, sir. No, sir. It was apart from his work schedule, and that was one of the difficulties he had with it. The other.
So after the training, he was required to still come back to do his night shift.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And so, anyways, he felt like it was also a reprimand as well that came along with that. And the test is, of course, is would it dissuade? It's considered an adverse employment action if it would dissuade a reasonable worker from making a charge of discrimination. If I'm going to make a charge of discrimination against an individual, and knowing that if I do, then that individual is going to be able to file false reports against me, that my supervisor is going to take, never giving me an opportunity to respond.
Did the supervisor investigate the report itself, though,
no.
And determine, and after investigation, and determine that maybe the reports were accurate, and therefore your client needed additional training?
I don't know if the reports happened between March 2nd and March 7th. Mr. Valderez was advised of the reports when he was reprimanded on March 7th. He asked for an opportunity to respond to them and was not given that. As far as what Ms. Liao, who was the supervisor, knew or didn't know, I don't know what kind of investigation she could have performed within a few days that did not involve talking to Mr. Valderez.
Okay, and when was he first ordered to go to training? March 8th?
It was at the March 7th meeting. And then, so that would be the one. The other one would be the termination of his employment. And it's an interesting set of facts surrounding the termination of his employment in this case. The evidence shows that Mr. Valderez met with the Human Resources Director, Ms. Liao. Candace Newton was the Human Resources Director. He also met with Ms. Liao and a few others. His wife was present at the meeting. She filed a supporting affidavit in this case. The meeting was set up because Mr. Valderez had concerns that, as being a PICU nurse, requires the nurses working together. That's what he put in his affidavit, that the nurses have to assist. You're dealing with infants and pediatrics and it's intensive care, and that the nurses had quit doing that. In addition to following the false reports, they weren't working with him. He at that meeting, advised the HR director, Ms. Liao, that he would not be able to continue as a PICU nurse because of the retaliation, the ongoing retaliation that he was experiencing. In other words, they're not working with him. He felt like he was putting himself in a position where something bad could happen towards one of the patients, and he was asking for them to stop the retaliation. The evidence shows, interestingly, that UMC at that time did not offer or make any effort to say, okay, we'll stop the retaliation. Instead, and what the summary judgment evidence shows is that Candace Newton, the HR representative for UMC, told Mr. Valdez that he could transfer from PICU to another department.
And somewhere in there, didn't Ms. Leal go to the people that are harassing him and tell him to stop or something like that?
Yeah, this is before the retaliation, yes, sir. On March 2nd is when he reported the conduct. And so on March 2nd, Ms. Leal went to the workers, and in fact, I think she went to the workers and said, Mr. Valdez has complained, it needs to stop. And that's from March 2nd, that happened on March 2nd. From March 2nd to March 7th is when the retaliation, the false reports were made, they stopped working with him or assisting him properly. The at that meeting, Ms. Newton and the affidavit from Mr. Valdez says explicitly, told Mr. Valdez that there were nursing positions available for him to transfer to, that he simply needed to choose a position and he would be able to transfer to that position. Mr. Valdez specifically told Ms. Newton that he could not afford to lose his job and was told by Ms. Newton that he was not resigning, but he was applying, and he was not going to, the policy said he resigned. And then you apply with all the other applicants for a job in a new position. Ms. Newton specifically told Mr. Valdez that she was making an exception for him in order where he was not going to have to resign and follow the standard application process to go into a new department.
Did he believe that Ms. Leal had that authority to give him that exemption?
Ms. Newton was the director of human resources, okay. And we believe that she did.
Ms. Newton told him, not Ms. Leal.
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay.
It was Ms. Newton. When he accepted that, and then later on that day when he went to the recruiting office to transfer to a new department, he was told, no, you have resigned and you need to reapply with the as any other new applicant. In other words, you're not going to simply be transferred. The Mr. Valdez's position in the case is he was duped into resigning. And it was part of the retaliation that was against him. The trial court, we believe, failed to follow the rules of summary judgment as far as just the simple, the basic, you're supposed to infer any disputed facts in favor of the non-moving party and make all reasonable inferences in favor of the non-moving party. With regard to the termination, the UMC had said.
Well, the claim you're making is that all of this was retaliation for his having earlier complained about the harassment he was receiving from the nurses.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. He had complained about a 4-month period of time of conduct by the nurses where they were just making derogatory remarks.
And he complained about that.
Yes, sir.
And that is the basis of that he complained about a practice made unlawful by Title VII.
Yes, sir.
And all of the other adverse actions that occurred to him flowed from that protest, is what you're saying.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
He had made that report on March 2nd. On March 7th, he was brought into Ms. Leal's office, reprimanded, placed on a training program based upon what he claimed were false reports. We understand those facts are disputed, but his and purposes of summary judgment, his evidence is to, his testimony is to be taken as true. And then on March 7th, he was placed on the training program. From March 7th until I think it was April 11th, within about a month, is when he met with him again to discuss all of this retaliation is occurring. I'm not able to perform my duties. And they, instead of attempting to stop the retaliation at that point, offered him a transfer, said they were going to make an exception for him. did not do that, we believe that creates a genuine issue of material fact on the issue of adverse employment action. And thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Dennis, we'll hear from you.
Court, counsel. My name is Don Dennis and I represent UMC. UMC is a large public hospital in Lubbock, Texas. Mr. Valdez was an employee there in the pediatric intensive care unit. He had transferred that department a short time before the incidents that we're here about arose. He had not been in that position for a whole year as the policy on transfers provides. We believe the evidence shows that Mr. Valdez has probably some unique sensibilities. The evidence for summary judgment purposes shows that he was kidding about a relationship with one of his friends, a male friend, and implications that there was a question about his sexual orientation. He also claims...
I mean, was he known... was he out of the closet, so to speak?
Your Honor, for purposes of this argument, he says he is not a homosexual.
Okay.
And
so, I mean,
the record does not indicate that he ever was.
Okay.
The kidding, though, involved that. He also.
Where does it come in about his wife? I mean, who created those kind of terms for his wife was there? Reprimand session, his wife was there.
That's down the line.
But whose wife is that? Is that a male wife?
No, it's female wife.
Okay. I thought they were referring to.
Do I think there's anything to the fact that they claimed or made comments about so and so is your boyfriend? How's your boyfriend doing? This is a kid that goes home to nurses.
Okay.
I don't believe it.
Oh, okay. I thought he was out of the closet. No. Trying to. Okay.
But discrimination on perceived sexual orientation is not a violation of Title VII, at least as it stands now. There was other kidding going on, too, based on his statements. He says he was kidded that, or the nurses would make statements, the female nurses would make statements that he was about as good a nurse because he was a female, or you don't get this because you're not a guy. He characterizes it all the time, happens all the time. And that's one of the problems with the plaintiff's case, is that he tries to base his case on assumptions, characterizations, and conclusions, and unreasonable inferences. For example, I was harassed, but he doesn't get to clarity about the facts which would allegedly create harassment as far as pervasiveness and severity. And another thing that's a moving target in this case is who was doing this. Both the retaliation, the claimed retaliation, and the claimed initial harassment. In his pleadings, he calls them co-workers. Other places, he calls them the female nurses. And then when he has to, he calls them, well, they were my supervisors.
But obviously, the hospital took those claims serious and investigated those claims and conclude. I mean, if they didn't think that it was a violation of any sort of rule, whether in-house or not, they simply would not have investigated. But what I appreciate the facts were, they took his complaint and mm-hmm. they investigated his complaint and then they determined that he was the one who would need training, right?
He was the one who was being what?
He was the one who would need additional training.
I still didn't understand you.
They invested, he went to management and said, my coworkers are saying all these things about me.
Yes.
Management then investigated those charges, right?
Well, I think they took him at face value. And they took him at face value, called a meeting of his coworkers, said stop
it. And stop that. I mean, so if they didn't think that was a problem, working with their workforce, they probably wouldn't even have done that, right?
But keep in mind that management takes action to stop things that go on in the workforce all the time, whether they're discriminatory or not, whether they rise to the level of harassment or not. There's no reason for a manager to put up a conduct like this, whether it's illegal or not. Stop it. This doesn't help the workforce. You kid somebody about having green hair. That doesn't help things.
But in this instance here, he was talking about, they're talking about my sexuality, my perceived sexuality, yes. And is it the hospital's position that a claim such as that does not touch on Title VII?
Yes, it's our position that a claim of perceived sexual orientation is not a prohibited characteristic. It's not a protected characteristic.
How does that fly with Uncal and the other cases from this circuit and from the Supreme
Court? I briefed that in a brief, but the law is that I think the law is settled on that, and the cases are set forth in my brief. Now, discrimination because of sex or gender is prohibited, and the position of the plaintiff is the comments that you're not a good nurse because you're a guy, you don't get it because you're a guy. Their position is those are gender-based and are sufficient to be a violation of the law. It's harassment.
Okay, so he complained.
He complained. It was stopped.
It was stopped.
Okay.
Now he claims that they retaliated against me because I complained, right?
Yeah. Now, then again, what was the retaliation? Well, I was ostracized. There's another one of those conclusions. I was ostracized.
His retaliation claim says I was sent to training. He said I was the one who was forced to go to training.
Oh, that was another thing. He said he was sent to training. But there's nothing to indicate that that was the result of retaliation. There were reports, and it's interesting that he does not come forward and show that those reports were false. Their medication orders, their records of medication given, a supervisor can look at those and tell whether the medication was provided correctly. Now, if it's not, and there's a question about patients not getting the medication at time, a diligent supervisor is going to do something about that. And this diligent supervisor said, you're going to have some training. Now, that doesn't make that training punitive. It just makes the training necessary. And how's training punitive? You get paid for the training. There's nothing to indicate he was expected to get the training without being paid for it, and it improves his ability. In fact, he complained before that he wanted training and didn't get it.
Was he required to do the training right after his shift?
No,
I heard today he had to work.
I don't think any of that is in the record. The specifics of that aren't in the record. And again, the plaintiff tries to make his case on conclusions, assumptions, and presumptions of facts that aren't in the record. This case was on file, I think, about 14 months before summary judgment was granted. The plaintiff had opportunity to take depositions, no depositions. Well, it's not in the record, but he had opportunity to take depositions, opportunity to send discovery during this time. Yet he still relies on presumptions and characterizations and conclusions rather than getting to the facts. Now, after he complained, the next complaint level was to Ms. Liao and Ms. Newton. And his complaint at that time was, I was ostracized, they made me take training, they're not helping me. Again, it's amorphous generalization. I'm being retaliated against because they're not helping me and assisting me with my work. There's no place in the record that explains how the details of that were, how often it happened, when it happened, was it serious, what kind of ostracization. Those are all subjective conclusions on his part. They're the shortcut for facts, which he cannot show. And again, we get back to the situation. He's working with female workers. He calls them co-workers, sometimes the female nurses. And occasionally he'll say, oh, yeah, they were my supervisors, without any proof of what authority they had over him. And I think the case law is clear that to be a supervisor, you have to have some authority other than just simply, will you go in to take care of this patient? You'll take care of that patient. And there's no proof in the record showing what retaliation, quote, retaliation was by his co-workers, and which, if any, was by a supervisor that really had a control over some significant aspect of his employment. That's just not in there. It's a general statement. Nurses ostracized me. Nurses wouldn't help me. What are the details? There aren't details.
I know he does raise that issue with respect to the other nurses would not help me, would not have my back or whatever. Is that supported by the record, though, or are these just statements in the
brief? That's a conclusion. That's a conclusion without specific incidents showing which nurses, because retaliation is something the employer does. It's not something a co-worker does. And I think the law in this circuit and a lot of other circuits are clear on it. And I think it's more stringent in this circuit than a lot of circuits, that before you hold an employee responsible for a retaliatory act, you've got to show it is by a supervisor, not by a co-worker. And
is there any evidence that he reported to his supervisors that these nurses were not backing him up in that unit? Because obviously it's important for nurses to back each other up in the PQ, right?
I don't think that there's evidence of that in the record that he reported. What happened ultimately was he was unhappy. He was unhappy. His perception, at least according to his affidavit, was they're not helping me, they're ostracizing me. And they made complaints against me, and those are false. And I can't prove they're false, but maybe if I hadn't, I could. And yet he didn't get them in discovery and did not come forward to show that they were in fact false. There's no showing that the nurse manager who made the decision to require the training thought that they were false. So we got an unhappy employee here.
Now, management did put him on call, right? Put him on call.
That's what I'm getting to.
Okay.
The sequence of events. So we've got an unhappy employee here, and he wants to meet with Ms. Liao. She gets the HR director involved. They have a meeting. He says, I'm unhappy, basically. I think it's unsafe working where I am. And sometimes he says it's unsafe because they won't help me. Sometimes he just says it's unsafe. But that's what he expresses. And the HR manager trying to do the right thing, trying to solve a problem, which is what they're paid to do, just like lawyers are paid to do, says, what kind of solution can we come up with? So she says, well, you haven't been in this job for a year, and so you're not eligible for transfer, but I'm going to make an exception for you. I'm going to allow you to transfer, even though you haven't been here a year. Okay. So that's the discussion. You need to go contact the nurse recruiter, find another position. We'll leave you on on-call status. Even though he wasn't working in that department, he was taken out of that position. He had a full-time position in pediatric intensive care. He was taken out of that position and put on call, which kept him on the books, on the database, as an employee. And
But he lost benefits and he lost payment and benefits.
Yeah, well, I think the benefits continued for some time. That's really unclear under the record. What isn't clear under the record is that this occurred on like April 11th, and it wasn't until later in that month before he was transferred officially to on-call status. And it wasn't until June 24th when a personal action form said that he was terminated, but it said taken off payroll.
But being on on-call status, does that reduce the pay and benefits that he was getting?
Yeah, but there's not an allegation that he was deprived of benefits and that was retaliation. Where they left it that day was, hey, normally you can't transfer. We'll waive that part of the rule. In essence, we'll waive that part of the rule. You need to contact Nurse Recruiting to find a position. Okay. That's not retaliatory treatment. That's extraordinary treatment. Now, here again, we have the subjective impressions of Mr. Valderez, who believes, based on that, that he can have any position he wants. Just have to pick one. I think that's in the record. I just have to pick one and I'll get it, without regard to whether they're more qualified applicants, more senior applicants, whether he's the best person for the job, or any of that.
What was told him during that meeting? What does a hospital contend was told to him during that meeting?
There was a conflict between his statement, the hospital and several witnesses, and affidavits say he was told that he would have to apply for an interview at jobs. And he says, they never told me that. And in his deposition, I asked him pointedly, did they ever tell you you didn't have to interview? No. Did they tell you you would have a preference? No. And the line of question that one. So where he thought he was going to be after this meeting was, I'm not going to be working because I'm taken out of that position. I'll need to interview, but he admits that he understands the transfer policy, that you got to apply and the department director has to accept you before you can transfer to another department. It's not just, you pick one and you just go there. He admits that and understands that, and he actually did apply. So after the meeting, he claims that he called and they said, call Nurse Recruiting. And they said, well, you're terminated. You have to reapply and interview for a job, okay? Well, so that's what happens when you transfer. So was he terminated? Does it matter what you call it, how you characterize it? What substantially happened was, you're no longer working in PICU. Everybody agrees that. He didn't want to work there. He wasn't going back to work there. His choices were to go back to PICU, which he said he would not do. His choice was to consider a transfer or to quit. And he was given the opportunity, an exceptional opportunity to transfer. But the exception didn't apply to all the other aspects of the transfer policy. It was never discussed. He just assumed they did. And when he contacted him, he said, you mean I have to reapply? I have to reapply and interview? Oh my gosh, I must be terminated. And he says, they told me I was terminated. Now, that could be a misunderstanding. There's no proof that anybody with authority to terminate him told him that.
They coded him out of the system, didn't they?
Excuse me?
And didn't they mark his file not employed here anymore?
No. There was no action on his personnel file till, I believe, late April. At that time, it said transferred on-call status. Okay. And then there's a scheduling policy that requires on-call to work four shifts over 4 weeks. And if you're not, then they take you off the ledger as employed. But in effect, when you quit, when you don't have a position, you're no longer seeing a paycheck for working, that's when whether you're on the books, not on the books, you don't have a position, you're not getting paid. He understood, or should have understood, that he needed to go interview, and he didn't. He interviewed twice, kind of halfway interviews, and there were other positions available. He didn't do it. He made the decision not to stay with UMC. There's no evidence that this was a ruse. That's his characterization, that's his assumption, because it serves its purpose.
Well, the affidavit that he did that conflicts directly with the testimony of the HR person, was that affidavit submitted post his deposition? Had he been deposed and answered all those questions
that
you said he had answered?
Yes.
And then does this affidavit conflict with that deposition testimony?
In some respect, it does. He says, I was not told I get interviewed. But he wasn't, I think what he said was, I assumed I didn't have to interview because they didn't say I had to interview. But he understands that's the policy, that you have to interview and you have to be accepted. So there's just no evidence to show that the reason he no longer is at DMC is because somebody wanted him gone for retaliatory purposes. He's not there anymore because he chose not to interview and pursue that diligently. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Okay, Mr. Johnston, we'll hear from you.
Thank you. I guess the first issue is there was a question about how is the training punitive? And I'm going to read from the affidavit. With regard to the affidavit, I do not believe that it contradicted the deposition at all. Had the deposition out, we went through it as we were preparing the affidavit to make efforts and to make sure that it didn't contradict any of the deposition testimony, and make sure it was consistent.
Why did he file an affidavit after he had testified?
Because the affidavit was directly related to the points being made in the motion for summary judgment. The deposition was a deposition taken by defense, and so it didn't address it wasn't the testimony that we were going to bring out at trial.
Okay.
And the affidavit was more pointed towards those issues, as we saw the important issues. With regard to the training, in his affidavit, he says, instead of allowing me a chance to defend myself against the allegations, Ms. Liao told me that I had to undergo additional training because of the complaints. She also told me that the training was being crafted in part by the female nurses that I had complained about and that I had told Ms. Liao had been retaliating against me. Prior to making the harassment discrimination complaint, I had requested additional training numerous times and it had always been refused. The training that was ordered after I made the complaint was not the type of training that I had been requesting, but was instead punitive in nature and was scheduled at times that made it very difficult for me to successfully complete the training.
Does he say why it was punitive in nature?
Well, a big part of it was the scheduling of it. And in this regard, though I worked nights, no efforts were made to set up night training, but all training was to be done during times I would ordinarily be asleep. It is my belief that the training was not designed to assist me, but was designed so the department would be able to manufacture an excuse to terminate my employment.
Does he supply any evidence for that?
Well, I think the scheduling of the training, if I work a 9-to-5 job and you schedule additional training for me at 3:30 in the morning, that's...
What
I,
time?
I well, what, some evidence
how long, of how long was his, how long was the training session?
I don't know. I think it was at least an hour or two, but it was being scheduled so in the middle in other of the words, day when he worked an overnight.
He would have to come in at 3:30 in the morning and stay until 4:30 in the morning and then go back home?
In context, remember, he worked a graveyard shift. I was just using that as an analogy. I mean, he worked overnight hours. He would have to come ordinarily when he was sleeping at, let's say, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, do his training, and then...
So he would have to come in to work an hour early or stay an hour late to get the training. Is that
well,
what
it wasn't scheduled that way. It was scheduled in the middle of the following day, or it was not scheduled on the... It wasn't bookended on his...
He would have to come back from home.
Yes, sir.
Do the hour schedule and then go back home.
Yes, sir. And then come back and do it. With regard to the meeting with the HR director where his employment was ended, first, he was taken out of a full-time position and placed on on-call, and I would believe that that's an inaccuracy.
But now that was, as I understand it, now you can tell me if I'm wrong, but he requested a transfer. He was not going to work in that department any longer. He asked for a transfer.
Well, his and hope they, was...
Is that right?
I'm just going to read the affidavit, if that's okay, because he addresses it more clearly than I would. But yeah, he wanted the department to correct the retaliation. He was not going to be able to do the work the way it was going. The department offered him the transfer. The HR director offered him. He said, I'm not going to be able to continue working in PICU. Okay, this is where the trial court just accepted everything UMC said as factual and ignored the controverting statements that Mr. Valderas made in his affidavit. In his affidavit, he said that Ms. Newton, instead of stating that she would take steps to correct the problems I was having, instead suggested that I transfer out of PICU into another department. In doing so, she explicitly and clearly told me that there were nursing positions available for me to transfer out of the department and that all I needed to do was choose one and I would be transferred to that department. I was specifically told by Ms. Newton that I was transferring, not that I was resigning and applying for a job in another department. In fact, she stated she was making an exception for me to do that. I agreed to do the transfer based upon the specific statements by Ms. Newton, the Human Resources Director, that it was in fact a transfer. I told her that I could not afford to lose my job because of a number of reasons, and she assured me that I was not losing my job, but was simply making a transfer to an existing position. I did not misunderstand what the Human Resources Director told me, and I relied upon her representations in agreeing to the transfer. She then told me to report.
All right,
to
now, did he ever come back to her and complain and say, look, I misunderstood you. It required me to transfer, which means I've got to resign my job. I don't want to do that. Did he ever come back to her? Was there any further discussion about that?
Well, he went to the recruiting office. It was closed. That he went later on that day and was told that he had been removed from, that he'd lost his job. He did not have
that. Who told him that?
In fact, it's not in the record, Your Honor, but I did send a letter to Ms. Newton myself because he came to me at that point, and I sent a letter trying to get a grievance started to try to correct that, and it was not ever considered or done or anything. So yeah, we did, but it's not part of
the record. In other words, it's not part of the record.
Yes, sir.
But it's not part of the record that he ever went back to her at any time and said, look, we had a misunderstanding. You've sent me over there. They tell me I've got to transfer and start all over, and that all I can do is bid on these jobs.
It is not part of the record before the court, but I'm telling you it was done. It was done
by you.
Yes, sir.
It was done by you some months later?
No, some weeks later. Within April of 2011.
But the same day that he got the bad news to him, that he was not going to be automatically transferred, he accepted that and never complained about that until he hired you.
He called me, I think, the next day and said, this is going on, what can we do? And I suggested we file a grievance. Because that was the hospital process at that point. Is what occurred.
Well, okay,
he felt like he couldn't go back to Ms. Leal or Ms. Newton.
Did file a grievance. Is that what you're saying?
Well, we attempted to. They said because you're no longer employed, you can't file a grievance. Is what they said about it.
In other words, if they put him on call, he was not employed.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Although he was employed, what on call means that he would come in and fill a vacancy if someone was out or absent, or what does that mean?
Yes, sir. You're basically a part-time employee, substitute, essentially. You go and fill
a substitute employee. And does that provide, if he had wanted to accept the calls, could he have been employed regularly, 40 hours a week?
There were no assurances of eventually, within a couple of months, he was able to apply for and get a job with a whole different entity, because he needed to work, so. But there was, at that point in time, no, there wasn't. And his concern was he felt like it was going to be real difficult to go through the application process simply because he had...
Okay, now somewhere in this morass of evidence and so on, I had seen that he did not accept the on-call opportunities that he had. And that's why he was eventually taken off the on-call list, because he would not accept the on-call request. Is that right or wrong?
That is correct. He did not. He felt like he needed to be working full-time, so he was seeking employment elsewhere and felt that the bridge with UMC...
And so while he was seeking employment elsewhere and was unemployed, he was rejecting the on-call offers that the hospital made to him. Is that right or wrong?
I know that he was never put on call. I really don't know, Your Honor, if he was ever told that there was an on-call position available on any given day. That was not, I'm not familiar with that part of the record.
Are you telling me he didn't know he was on call?
No, that he knew he was on call, but I don't know that there was ever a call made to him saying, hey, we have this position, can you come in and work today? That part I don't know. I don't want to make anything misrepresentation. I don't know that. I'm not sure what the process is.
He did not say whether there were any opportunities one way or the other. He did not say yes or no as to whether he had an opportunity on the on-call docket to work full-time. That's not in the record?
No, not that specific statement. I believe the on-call by its nature is part-time. It's not. I don't believe there's 40 hours of work available on on-call.
What does the record say?
It doesn't say anything about it, Your Honor.
So we don't have any definition of what on-call. Nobody put into the record what on-call means.
No, sir.
Lord, okay. So it could mean 40 hours a week, 60 hours a week, or 10 hours a week.
Well, I think the general understanding is it's a part-time nature. That's my belief, and I believe that's just the general understanding of the term. If somewhere is incredibly understaffed, then yes, it could be a full-time. I mean, you could get 40 hours, but you're not considered a full-time employee.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. That completes the arguments that we have on the oral argument calendar for today. Indeed, it completes the arguments that this panel has for this week. So.